We designed a management body which we called the Nunavut Lands Authority. It's basically an administrative body that hands out leases and licenses to developers and collects the economic rent, which is to be split amongst both levels of government, the Nunavut government, the federal government, and the Inuit. We haven't discussed that at the table yet, so it's unclear as to where we will go with that. Other parts of the land and resource package included a water management board, water management system. We realized that you can't own water, but you can have certain rights when it comes to water, rights to clean water, rights to free running water, access to water, the ability to take resources from that water. So we decided that that was the approach we had to take. So we set up a water board and gave Inuit those kinds of rights. We haven't negotiated that part of the package yet either, so things take a while to come. We also negotiated topics on national parks, on conservation areas, archaeological sites, outpost camps, and municipal lands. In deference to Australians' concerns this morning on cultural aspects, one of the major intentions of our archaeological package was to ensure there was a protection of archaeological sites, that Inuit be involved in any kind of excavation of it, and that artifacts that are currently not within Nunavut be returned to Nunavut. We're still at loggerheads as to who actually owns the artifacts. The federal government will not concede that they belong to Inuit, but that they are part of the national collection for all Canadians. We also did the same thing with ethnography. When it came down to the actual identification of lands that people were interested in, the federal government tried to constrain us with a number of principles. There was about a 10-page package of the do's and don'ts of land identification. And these were not acceptable to us. And we said to them that, okay, before we talk about these principles that you're so interested in, we want to talk about the purpose of land identification. What is the primary purpose for Inuit to own land? And we got the federal government to agree that the primary purpose is economic self-sufficiency. And with that purpose, we were able to negotiate other principles behind it, which said that if the primary purpose is economic self-sufficiency, in order to meet that goal, Inuit would have to be able to own lands for reasons of subsurface or mineral value, of renewable resource value, of commercial or industrial value, of conservation value, of areas that were important to people for spiritual and cultural reasons. So we established that those basic purposes of owning land, and then boiled down the federal document to about a page and a half of principles, which certainly doesn't give us everything that we want, but it gives us the flexibility to be able to negotiate with government for areas that do have subsurface value or areas that are currently held by third-party interests, a whole range of issues. So we try to provide some flexibility. The previous settlements have kind of given people a lump sum of land, at least that's my understanding, that you kind of settle on how much land is the federal government is prepared to turn over, and then you kind of carve it up amongst all the communities. In our case, that's not appropriate, nor is it really possible. I think using the parameters of these purposes and principles, that communities on a case-by-case basis should identify lands that meet their economic self-sufficiency over time. And at the end of the day, you add up the mileage from all the communities and all the regions, and that becomes your sum total. But we haven't negotiated the process that is required to carry this through. We have negotiated municipal lands. the primary purpose for negotiating that was to give the municipalities, as municipalities, control over the backyard. And the way it stands now is the municipalities will have jurisdiction over wide areas. They'll identify the areas in which they need. And these areas shall be identified in such a fashion as to meet their long-term needs of growth. In other words, they have water, quarry rights, or recreation. They can select lands for recreational needs, municipal services, expansion of the community, and so on. There's another part of the land and resource picture that unfortunately has been lost in other areas, and I think part of it is a perception that land claims involves only land. In the case of the Inuit, the offshore is absolutely critical. All but one community in our area is located on the coast. And people, I think, derive as much, if not more, benefits, more resources from the sea than from the land areas. The federal government really doesn't have a policy on offshore claims when it comes to dealing with Inuit. If there's any policy at all, its policy is that it's not on. The federal government has recognized that we do have some rights when it comes to wildlife in offshore areas, but we don't think that that goes far enough. We think that we have rights and interests over seabed resources, over ice areas, and that we intend to negotiate these. And in fact, in all our agreements to date that have any relation to the offshore, such as planning or impact review or whatever, we always flag it that this is not to prejudice future discussions in offshore talks. There could be, our offshore package hasn't been fully put together yet, and I suspect a lot of it will turn on how successful we are in negotiating management responsibilities over land. If the mechanisms, the management structures, and so on are satisfactory to meet our needs on lands, then perhaps it's just a matter of extending those into offshore areas. If they're not particularly satisfactory or appropriate, then we may have to look at other means of handling our offshore areas. When it comes to the economic package, we kind of have an approach that says that you get it where you can, that we have to be able to receive economic benefits from many, many areas, and these benefits have to come in over time. I think the federal government views the compensation package as something that is finite, and once it's been handed out, there shouldn't be really any more monies coming in. The federal government isn't happy with the notion of royalties, and if they were to negotiate royalties with us, they'd make sure that the royalties were capped. We've tried to cover our economic needs through a number of ways. Certainly land is an important economic asset, as are renewable resources. In areas where we can get subsurface resources, that is a tremendous economic benefit. We're looking at negotiating special employment programs for Inuit involvement in the federal and territorial governments as a means of securing economic benefits. We tried to, and have been successful in negotiating Inuit impact and benefit agreements as it relates to development, when it comes to establishment of conservation areas, national parks. When it comes to negotiating these things with outside developers, we're at loggerheads with the federal government right now, because the federal government does not want independent arbitration when it comes to settling some kind of dispute between a developer and an Inuit organization negotiating these packages. The federal government believes that the minister should have the responsibility. We're not prepared to accept that. And an area that we're just starting to look at is how can we tap into federal programs in a more comprehensive fashion, and how do we mix these things with our compensation monies. Right now, the federal and territorial governments sit down and negotiate economic development agreements and subsidiary agreements and so on, but there are no positions on the Policy Advisory Committee, for instance, for Inuit to sit there and help form economic policy. There are no positions for Inuit on the management committees that review proposals for people. We're looking at ways of trying to get people into that system so they can help develop a stronger economic future, one that's more appropriate for the North, and looking at ways of how we can integrate those with monies and economic benefits that are coming in over time. The other area is the social provisions. They are probably the most important aspect of the package. They pale in comparison when you talk about billions of dollars in development and so on. They kind of get lost in the shuffle, but it's an absolutely critical area because these are the things that really come down to people at the communities, the major concerns such as housing and health and education and language. Language, I should mention that one way we're ensuring that people's language rights are looked after is that we make an Inuktitut, along with the other official languages of Canada, as the languages of the business of the boards that we're establishing. So these boards are going to have to operate in an Inuktitut, and the minutes, everything will be done within the Inuit language as well as English and French. We're looking at these areas now. We haven't completed the research on it, so there's not a great deal I can say about it. There are some other areas that have to be negotiated, such as eligibility and enrollment, processes of land identification, the ratification process, taxation. Taxation is something we're quite concerned about. I understand the Alaskans may have to give up large areas of land in 1991 as a result of taxation laws and not being able to hold on to it. And we're also looking at corporate structures. At this point in time, I should back up a step and say that we do have a development corporation, which is a profit-making corporation. It was set up to take advantage of business opportunities and to handle the land claims money when it comes out of the settlement. Right now, there are other elements in the organization that are questioning following that route and trying to explore new ideas to see whether there are other appropriate models that would perhaps better meet people's interests. And I guess I won't take any more of your time, Mr. Chairman. That's basically, in a nutshell, what we've been trying to do with the claims process, how we've approached it. And certainly there's a long way for us to go. It takes a long time to get this done if you want to get a good settlement. You can have a settlement tomorrow, but it depends on what you're prepared to accept. And the Inuit are not prepared to accept just anything. They want to make sure their long-term needs are met in terms of rights, and in terms of their management responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. I think that I will adjourn for just a few minutes for a coffee break, and then I'll confer with some of you and see how we should most effectively use the remainder of our time. But I think we do want to hear from the representatives of the Aboriginal people of Australia again, and Alf Isaac Kiskatalo again, before we adjourn. Peter Atinwar, you wanted to add something.
Well, just to conclude the presentation from this table, we presented our case in two parts. There are others. Some of our people from other organizations could not come. For instance, the Inuit Committee on National Issues, which deals with the Canadian Constitution and the work in progress. Members from the Nunasi Corporation could not come, which corporation-wise has been mentioned a great deal around the table during the past few days. To some people, our proposal seems moderate or compromising. Well, we try to be realistic in the, first of all, in the political climate of Canada and the attitudes from other ethnic groups towards our, or from the largest society towards minorities, and we've tried to deal with it so that we, while our interests are accommodated, there has to be a quid pro quo somewhere. And so this is, keeping this in mind, we've tried to fashion our Nunavut proposal, which is, all of it is really a Nunavut proposal, including what Randy Ames has been talking about, so that this is acceptable in the best Canadian tradition while keeping a very unique character to the whole case. Sovereignty was mentioned around here a good deal. I think it was Mark Gordon who said that sovereignty means having the biggest guns. Well, I think that in a nutshell is the definition that Randy Ames gave to sovereignty. It is not realistically possible to be totally sovereign, at least in Canada, in that part of the landmass. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and we'll try and field questions if there's time. If not, well, that's fine. Thank you.
We'll take a break for a coffee. Steve, I'll call on you for 30 seconds just to start the ball rolling, eh? Let's just begin again. We've got about 45 minutes, and what I was going to do is give Steve Cackrey of the Denny Nation about 60 seconds, and then we'll hear from the, well, that's all he asked for. And then we'll hear from the Australian Aboriginal people. And then I would like to call on Alf Isaac Cascatallo of Samiland. And then Charlie Edwardson, who goes back a long way in Alaskan land claims, would like to say something. And then Douglas Sanders, who started the ball rolling on Tuesday, and then Daly Sambo, and of the ICC. And then I think by that time the people with their bingo cards will be coming into the hall and we'll have to leave. Steve, you can start off now if you would.
Okay, I asked for a little bit of time just to, on behalf of our delegation from the Dene, to thank the people that organized this conference and for the other delegations from other parts of the world, for the Alaskans, for allowing us to visit. And more or less just saying thank you very much on behalf of the Dene. We enjoyed it very much. And I think this sort of exchange should continue more often, perhaps in the future. And just to thank all of you.
Sure, your name?
Well, first, an advertisement on behalf of our host here, the Indigenous people of this country. At 6:10 p.m. today, the Anchorage Community Centre in room K201, there's going to be a bit of a cultural thing on tonight, put on by the local people here, and we'll all be there, and I think probably we can say our goodbyes and thank yous and everything at that place. I might save some time here. I've got a couple of things that have bothered me during the week, pretty much so, and I think probably the strongest statement and the statement that makes the most sense to me that I've heard all week came just before lunch from Mike Alberts. And I think it's something that we've got to look at and take very much in note of. What we've got to remember is that any agreements, treaties, or whatever we make at the present time is not only affecting us right now. You know, we're, as an Indigenous people, we're one of the oldest people in the world. We're timeless people. We have time. We have time to sit down, think about things, talk between each other, and come up for the best deal that we can for our children and their children. We are only visitors here, and the lands that were handed down to us from our ancestors have been handed down since the beginning of time, and we're only guardians over those lands. Our job as a people is to ensure that those lands and all the life that live on those lands continue, so that we have a heritage, we have something for our children. And I don't care if 50,000 mining companies and 20,000 governments are on our back to give up that land, to give up our rights over that land. I think if we sell our children out, then we can never hold our heads up. One of the things, I've been around the world many times, as my position in the organization I work for. I've talked to Indigenous peoples throughout the whole world. And every time we sit down, we never talk about ourselves. We talk about our children and what we must leave for them. And if we sell them out, then we have no right in future lives coming back to that land. And that's what we must think about. Our people talk about we all have a place to be born in, we all have a place to die in. When our spirit goes back to where it comes from and then comes back in the next life, we must have a place to reborn ourselves in. You know, I'm a bit of a selfish sort of a guy myself. We believe that we come back in the fifth or sixth generation through our family line, and that's how we go back to our ancestors. And what man is going to sell himself out so that he has no place to come back to? That's what we all got to think about. There have been many other things that have worried me. The constant reference to ethnic groups. While I'm in Alaska, I make up a very small ethnic group here, the three of us. When we go home, we're an Indigenous group. We belong to a nation of Indigenous people, because we belong to that country. The other thing I was very concerned about was a constant reference to dissidents. And I talked to Mark Gordon last night, and now I feel happy that I can talk here, because I did talk to him last night about this. The next couple of things I'm going to mention. If I hadn't talked to him, I wouldn't have mentioned it here, because I like to let people know what I'm talking about. But there was a constant mention of 30% of his people were dissidents. How can 30% be dissidents? dissident is one person who disagrees with everybody else. Yesterday, when a question was asked to our brother from the Yukon, he said that three bands were dissidents. That's one quarter of those people. They cannot be dissidents. There are a quarter of the people who are not agreeing with the agreement as it is, and if it's given time, maybe you're going to have three quarters of the people, maybe 99%, if it's explained properly. And I think that's what we've got to think about. We've got to think about all those things. The other reference, and I heard it again this afternoon, was to the guy with the biggest gun has sovereignty. Well, we know about the big guns. The people in the Pacific region here in Alaska know about the big guns. There have been over 220 atomic tests in the Pacific region, destroying our lands and directly affecting our people. 9 in my country, 66 in Micronesia, over 100 in French Polynesia, and France, Britain, and US have the big guns. And effectively, that type of talk wipes out any mention of lands for any of the people in the Pacific who are not independent today. The other thing about a lot of the agreements, a lot of people have got to think about that. The British, when they invaded our country, learnt from what happened in America. There has never been a treaty or an agreement made with Aboriginal people because of the problems they caused in America. In 1972, when Justice Woodward made his report on the Northern Territory Land Right Bill, he went to Canada. He studied the white paper. He talked to both Canadian governments and Indigenous governments, and then came back and put up the Northern Territory Land Right Bill. And we got certainly a worse deal in that than some of the deals that were made in Canada, which are pretty bad when I look at them, from my way of thinking anyhow. And certainly, Sheldon today asked us what effect would the deal here in Alaska have effects in Australia. And I bet you anything you like, the Australian government has experts looking at that right now before they do any deal for us. And every deal that's done, the other governments are looking at it. So every time a deal is done somewhere, other Indigenous people are going to suffer because of that. And, you know, again, we heard from the Yukon yesterday that the deals already done have had bad effects on that agreement. And I think they're things that people must look at. We, at the present time, are going through an international law process. It's something I haven't heard much of here today. There are international laws. Countries do have to comply with them. There are international agreements which most of the North American countries have already signed. And they do have to stand by them. And I think one of the things that we have to do internationally, Indigenous people internationally, is stop listening to our lawyers for a kickoff and start talking to each other and uniting and start to work on the international law scene and put some heavy stuff in there and see the best deal. As adult people, let's put our heads together. Let's put our minds together, adult minds, respecting each other and respecting what we can get for our children. I think I'll leave it there and I'll hand it over to Maureen.
Maureen Kelly.
I won't elaborate too much on what I have to say because my brother over here says what we feel in our hearts. As a visitor here, I'd just like to say thank you to the generous people of the Indigenous Nation for inviting me here, and I hope that what I've learned here will apply to my people when I get back. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen Kelly. Alf Isaac Kiskatalo. Thank you. I am going to try to summarize in some way some thoughts and reflections that I've been able to gather together here.
in the course of these days. First of all, I would say that it has been a very good and intense experience to be here, to hear about concretely how and what has happened in the history and negotiation of land claims and of the perspectives for the future that are drawn up. I would like to point to one particular thing that has that I've been seeing as very important. It's the fact that in North America, at least, and as compared to my homeland, Sami land, there is seemingly a process. There are two processes seemingly moving in the opposite direction. Here, it seems to be that the governments of Canada and the United States had expressed that there is a sort of Aboriginal title. And then the land claims and the settlement of these claims seem to some extent to have been serving to extinguish those titles. As we experience it at home, it's first of all the very hard attempt to formulate our own history and background inside a society in such a way that it can be made credible for the authorities that we are eligible for a process that can be referred to a concept of Aboriginal title. It has, so to say, to do with this sort of what one in rough terms could call the stealing of history, the subjugation of history. That it has taken a lot of research and consciousness making in order to erect again in the last decades, because it's a process that's taken so long time, for several hundreds or a couple of thousand years even, in the contact between the Sami people and the neighboring large peoples. Since there has been posed a concrete question as for what impression the ANCSA agreement has made, I would like to try to answer it very shortly. The first time we saw the book, so to say, it occurred to be some sort of a fabulous experience that there had been somewhere a settlement on land rights. But immediately when someone started to discuss it, or to discuss the relevance of such a land settlement, which it might have for us, it occurred that the so-called checkerboard effect seemed unnatural, in a sense, at least to us. It also seemed unnatural that it was probably, it seemed limited in relation to the whole area of Alaska. It also seemed unnatural that the eligibility to rights was formed in the form of shares or stocks that possibly later could be traded. I
say this quite frankly, that's what we've been talking about. And since it was a direct question, so is the impression we had. So both in relation to the ANCSA settlement, to the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement, to the plans of Nunavut, the COPI agreement, which we have been able to look into later, they have, so to say, a double effect on our situation. The first effect is that it's some sort of encouragement in the fact that there is defined a sort of valid concept of Aboriginal title on which the government has to negotiate in some sense. But of course then there is a sort of negative assessment of the fact that when negotiations take place, there is so considerable a part of what seemed naturally to be included in a settlement that so far has not occurred. We have been concentrating very much on the question of subterranean resources, the rights, revenues, so on, relating to them. On the other hand, what has been a sort of profit that we have drawn from this in the process that's going on is the fact that it has been possible to start negotiation of Sámi claims in two boxes. One constitutional and political box, and the other, which is a land claim box, and press forward the political and constitutional box first, so that any amendment of the political status of our people is bound to influence the settlement of land claims, and if there is no amendment of our political status, then of course we are very free to define what type of stance you are taking to land claims questions. On the whole, I'll say that both we are following very closely what is happening in Australia, New Zealand, in North America. But I would say that it's important to draw attention to the fact that this is related to a very large question of human rights. It's related to the case of indigenous peoples who cannot, because of almost deadly suppression, articulate themselves around the world. And therefore it is a responsibility for Aboriginal people who can and are allowed to express ourselves, to take part in the process wherever we can to promote the human rights movement in that direction. And I'm, for instance, pointing to the work that's being done towards the covenant on the rights of indigenous peoples. And I can mention that this is being currently, we try currently to do something on this in Norway in cooperation with Nordic and Norwegian authorities on, for instance, the Foreign Department of Norway. It sounds perhaps strange that we are able to work together with the government in this sense, but I think that we will continue working together with the government in this sense, even if none of our claims ever are acknowledged, because we see it so important to
to contribute what we can, even if it might not be very much, to the international promotion of human rights and indigenous rights. And I think I'll try to conclude there, and I'll thank Justice Berger for the invitation and opportunity to come here. I'll also thank Inuit Circle Polar Conference, who has inaugurated this process. Thank you very much. Thank you all for company and presence.
Thank you, Ralph Isaac. We all appreciate your coming to represent the people of Samiland, and we hope that the connection, it already exists, but I hope that your presence here will strengthen that connection. I think we have time now to hear from two Alaskans, Charlie Edwardson Jr. and then Daley Sambo.
First of all, I would like to extend your welcome to Alaska. Alaska is a very distinctive place for the simple fact that there are three political instrumentalities in Alaska. One is the Native administration have survived Alaska Native land claims for the simple fact that the Alaska Native land claims was not a jurisdictional act, and that sovereignty, limited sovereignty, is in session, federated by the chaotic American Indian law. And our experience today is a amalgamation of all of these struggles of territorial invasion that has occurred from the Anglo-Saxon community. However, since the Inuit Circumpolar Conference had their first meeting, we have made some successes. We have not been shiftless. As you well know, the Alaskan Eskimo Whaling Commission and the Eskimo whaling was under assault from the world. We now have secured, under Inupiat administration, a world model in securing management of the bowhead species, which gives us extraterritorial jurisdiction. And since Alaska Native land claims was not a jurisdictional act, although that there are a lot of insecure Alaskans that feel that ANCSA had solved everybody, I would like to wake them up again and say that it is far from over, and that that the Constitutional Forum of the United States is open to Alaska Native people, and we are now engaging in a boundary dispute between United States of Alaska, United States of America, State of Alaska, and the Inupiat. We are going to have a clear definition of what the boundary of State of Alaska is, who is State of Alaska, what does it have, what did it disclaim, who is United States, and where is a shared responsibility, a shared jurisdiction is. And we feel that that in this boundary between Canada and United States, across our common sea, the Beaufort Sea, we would like to extend the claim to Canada beyond the 100 miles Canadian Waters Act, because for the fact that we can inform the Canadians that the Inuvialuit have used more than 100 miles of water. So the extraterritorial use and occupancy of our sea lanes, sea rights, have not been surrendered by Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act. And one must remember that Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is subject to the will of the majority because it is a legislative mandate. It is not a negotiated settlement. It was lobbied by the forces of a body who is easily influenced by something else. And because of that, it is open for amendments. Nothing in Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is sacred. And so Congress was even unsure of itself, of its monster that it had created, for the simple fact that they had found an opportunity for a 1985 report. So I feel that the forum and the evolution of this settlement and some of the planned disorganization, here is a settlement package in the world that had identified $1 billion without defining revenue. The village corporation and the regional corporation are still fighting who owns what. And so the subsurface estate was split up in half, and the corporate model is really devastated the